Hey, everybody, it's Brian, host of the Work in Sports podcast. Before we get into today's episode with Zach Logsdon, who's the founder of Old Hat Creative, which is a sports marketing agency, he's also the author of two really great books and hosts a podcast, so you know I'm going to like this guy. Interview's great. You guys are going to love it. But before we get into that, I want to give a quick shout out to our friends at Temple University. You can learn the skills needed to excel in one of the country's largest and most exciting industries, the sports industry. And you can learn it straight from sports professionals at Temple University's School of Sport, Tourism, and Hospitality Management. You can earn a master's degree that's designed to give you inside access to the growing multi-billion dollar sports industry. To learn more about this great program, or even just get started today, visit STHM, that stands for Sport, Tourism, and Hospitality Management, sthm.temple.edu/sports. Thank you, Temple.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0, ignition, liftoff.
Hi, everybody. I'm Brian Clapp, Director of Content for WorkinSports.com, and this is the Work in Sports podcast. Could you imagine being 5 years out of college and starting your own sports marketing agency? Forget even being that specific. Could you imagine being 5 years out of college and trying to run anything completely by yourself? I'll admit, I was totally codependent in my 20s. I needed someone else, thank you, Sandy Malcolm, if you're listening, to help steer me, to guide me through my career decisions, to help me focus and understand the larger business around me. Heck, even just to tell me what to do on a day-to-day basis. Not Zach Logsdon. This guy. That's my John Gruden impression. You like that? This guy. This guy graduates from University of Oklahoma with a degree in advertising and starts working for a big advertising firm right out of college. I'm guessing he missed sports, so he left his big firm after 2 years and starts heading up the graphic design team for his alma mater's athletic program. So he's at the University of Oklahoma. Dream gig, right? Pretty happy with where he's at in his career. 3 years after that, he's, I think I can do this myself. Let's start an agency from scratch. Are you insane? Like, literally, are you insane? I've always thought I was a pretty motivated and confident dude, but I would not have the ability to do what Zach Logsdon has done. But then again, starting an agency isn't the same as owning a successful agency. Many go under in a short time frame. But again, here's where Zach's, kind of above the curve. 17 years later, not only is Old Hat Creative still thriving in the sports industry, working with college athletic programs and many others across the country involved in sports, but he's also written two books, hosts a podcast, and every once in a while, he sleeps. Here's the fun part. In this interview, we aren't just going to travel down memory lane discussing how he got where he is. I mean, we're going to do a little bit of that, but primarily we're talking about the now. Understanding fan behavior, marketing to today's generation of sports fans, the direction of the sports industry and where it needs to change course, and more. After this podcast is over, if you're anything like me, you'll probably subscribe to Zach's podcast, which is called Winning is Not a Strategy, and you might buy one of his books. One of them is actually named Winning is Not a Strategy also. The other one is If Not for Athletics. I did. I literally subscribed to his podcast, and I bought one of his books today. I'm not great at endorsing competing podcasts because I want it all for myself. I'm a greedy person that way. But so it takes a lot for me to tell you all to listen to someone else. So you know that I mean it when I say it's worth subscribing to. But for right now, stay where you are. Stay focused in this conversation and listen in to my interview with Zach Logsdon. Hey, Zach, how's it going today?
Great. How are you?
I'm doing really well. So a little backstory for everybody. Zach and I were supposed to do this interview like 2 weeks ago, but we had some conflicts in schedule. My kids got sick, that kind of thing. And then last week, Zach was on the road like every day, it seemed like, to work with clients. And I'm following this through your LinkedIn profile as you did videos from the airports and various places. And I mean, is that just part of like owning your own marketing firm, is that you're always going to be on the road and in the airports and things like that? Is that part of your life?
You know, I, For some reason, I got this wild idea. Well, first of all, I'm terrible at social media, Ryan. I throughout the course of the day, there are so many people that are good at seeing things and posting things and seeing articles and posting them, and I'm not. I see a great article, I think, oh, that's a good article. Never occurs to me to share it with anybody, right? So I had to figure out a way to kind of get myself in a comfortable way out on social media more. So on my 42nd birthday back in January, I launched this idea. Every morning I'm going to shoot a video. I'm going to call it Good Morning Sports Biz. And regardless whether I have something to talk about or not, I'm going to shoot it. I usually try to make it 3 to 4 minutes long, so it's easily viewable. Nobody's going to get too bored. And I've been doing those since January 18th. I'm on day 28 now. But it's my way of being better at getting some content out there, because like I said, I'm not, throughout the course of the day, I get so busy, and the last thing on my mind is thinking about posting on social media. So I drive to work most of the days. I do that driving to work because I got no other distractions. I set my camera up on my dashboard. I record something. But last week, yeah, I was doing so much travel. I was gone 4 of the 5 days. So three of them were from airports, and one of them was from the campus of Eastern Michigan University. So.
Oh, boy. Yeah, it's funny you say that, because when I first started in the sports media, you're transitioning from being a fan to being an employee. And I remember for the first year, I'd say, I'd read a story. You know, I'd be on ESPN.com or reading some newspaper, USA Today or whatever it would be. And I'd be like, wow, that's a great story. And I'd never think like, oh, wait, I'm the one that's supposed to be telling people about that.
Right, exactly. Yeah, I do it all the time. Read, oh, man, that's a great tweet that I just read. Done, yeah. You know.
Exactly, and then it's like out of my brain. Okay, so before we get into all the finer details of sports marketing, fan behavior, your career, I want to get into your personal story a little bit, you know, the when and the why kind of thing. When did you figure this out? When did you figure out you wanted to pursue a career in the marketing side of sports, and why? Why was this your passion? Why was this your goal? Why was this something you were striving for?
Well, I didn't even know it existed. I went to work at an advertising agency in Oklahoma City right out of school. I had a degree in advertising, and I didn't know that sports marketing was really a thing. I've told this story a few times, but my job out of college, they asked me, they said, call down to OU. We need their logo for something, for presentation we're putting together. So I called down to OU, got transferred around 47 times, and finally got to the right person. And he was the graphic designer for the OU athletic department. And he sent me the logo. And I said, if you ever have a job open there, that's my dream job. I would love to do that. Didn't even know that was a possibility.
Right.
And 6 months later, he emailed me and said, hey, I just turned in my resignation. If you're interested in this job, here's the link to apply. I applied, I got the job, and off to the races. But had I known that was a career option for me, I would have probably pursued it much earlier in life. I just didn't know. This has been, 1995 was when I graduated high school. I don't think it was publicly, well known that you could pursue a career in sports.
It's true. I'm a couple years older than you. I graduated college in 96, and same thing. I, my first 2 years of college, and I've told this many times before, I was a biology and chemistry double major. I just had no, I thought I'd go into physical, I thought I'd go into physical therapy or something like that, like kind of peripherally sports related. And then, all of a sudden kind of took a broadcasting class and was like, this is cool. I don't know. I had the same experience. And now it's like there's sports management programs at like 700, yeah. 700 different schools have sports management programs.
Yeah, crazy, crazy.
So let's talk about that initial step at Ackerman McQueen, which was the big firm that you originally worked for. I have mm-hmm. this belief that since I started out my career at CNN Sports, I kind of feel like I learned initially, that was like my master's program almost. Like I learned the right way things were supposed to be done, the best practices, all those sort of things. Was that your kind of same experience at a large firm where you got exposed to, I don't know, just the big scale of marketing and what it could be?
Definitely got exposed to a ton there. I graduated with a degree in advertising, which means that you know barely anything about a whole lot of things. I didn't have any really marketable skill, but it was there that Dean Wilhite, he was a art director there, was my mentor, taught me everything I know about design, and really that's where I cut my teeth and learned how much I loved design. So I learned in a very short period of time, a year and a half was really the only time I spent there, and learned so much about design and the concept of design, and that's really what I wanted to pursue, at least early in my career. I also learned a ton about what I didn't want, which was I did not want to work in advertising. In the corporate world of advertising, the business of advertising is very cutthroat. It's very, you work till 9 o'clock every night. If you leave at six, they used to say, oh, you're taking a half day. Yeah. And that was not what I wanted for my life. It's a different breed of cat that works in advertising in the big agency corporate world, and that was not what I was cut out for. It's not what I wanted. So that's it taught me a lot about what I wanted to do and a lot about what I did not want to do. I knew eventually I would run my own company. It's been a dream of mine since I was little, and it taught me how I didn't want to run my business. And then taught me that if I wanted to have an ad agency or a marketing agency, I probably needed to focus on something outside the corporate realm, because that was not that's not what I was cut out for.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's important stuff, is learning what you don't want just as much as what you do. But pretty quickly, I mean, you get that dream role at University of Oklahoma. You're working in graphic design. And then, 3 years later, you're opening up your own marketing agency at the ripe old age of the mid-20s, I'm guessing.
Right. I was 26.
Yep. Yeah. So that sounds crazy to me. How often, literally, how often did you cry yourself to sleep in the first early days of starting your own agency? Because I cannot imagine that being less stressful than working for a big advertising firm.
Yeah, I was definitely sick to my stomach. I mean, just pits in my stomach. I remember it was funny. I went to spend a few bucks on office supplies, and I think I probably spent $80 on office supplies just to get me, post-it notes and those things. And I was sick over it. I was like, this is the biggest mistake of my life. Who am I to think that I can go spend $80 on office supplies? I'm going to go bankrupt. And, ended up working out okay. But yeah, that first little bit, it's hard to convince yourself to do it. And then when you finally do it, I've lost a lot of sleep I've never caught up. I still lose sleep over it.
Well, then it never goes away.
It's just you losing sleep over different things.
Yeah, for sure. Then you have kids and it just gets worse, right?
Right. Yeah, exactly. When I started Old Hat, I had a 1-year-old and a mortgage, and I was leaving a very secure job at one of the biggest universities, athletic programs in the nation. And people told me, they're like, you're nuts, Zach, you are completely nuts. Why in the world would you do this? And had very few people saying, no, you'll be fine, do it. My father actually was very supportive. He was a lifelong entrepreneur, and he said, nope, if this is what you want to do, that's definitely what you should do. You'll be fine.
Well, it's great to have that.
But I did.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, but let's really dig into that, because I'm hearing it. I'm hearing all the words you're saying. They make sense. And yet I'm still sitting there thinking, you had a motivation of saying you wanted to do this. This was always something in the back of your mind. But how did you see success? Like, how did you know you'd be able to get clients? And how did you know you'd be able to make this work? Or did you? And where did you get that confidence to make that leap?
I didn't. I didn't know I'd be successful. My hope was that I'd still be in business a year later, and even that seemed unlikely. I've always subscribed to the idea that I'd rather try and fail than not try. Failure was okay. I've always been fine with failure. I've never been okay with not trying things, and that's just my personality. It's not right or wrong. It doesn't make me. It's just how I am. It is that the idea of working for someone else my entire life and not pursuing my dream was unacceptable. Pursuing my dream and failing at it perfectly acceptable. I've failed at so many things. It's not even funny. I have so many bad ideas that don't see the that you know I try and are terrible and I nix them before they embarrass me too bad. But I'm all about trying things and failing at them. Like I said, I don't mind. What I mind is not trying, because that eats away at me. That keeps me up at night. The failure never keeps me up at night.
Is that part of the creative process? Because I've worked around, I mean, having worked in the sports media, I've worked around very creative people for my entire career. And I noticed that trend is that I had a reporter once, and he would come to our brainstorming meetings, and he would have 10 ideas every time, and 9 of them would be insane. Like, I'd be like, there's no way we could do that. Like, we can't tell that story, or we can't do that, or we don't have the technology, whatever. And then one of them would be complete gold. Is that right? part of the process is to just totally free your mind up to be able to contemplate anything?
Well, I think to work in a creative position, you have to be, you know, it's subjective, you know, whether or not somebody likes something. And you put every single day, you put yourself in the position for somebody to not like what you did. And you have to be okay with that, and you have to get used to it. I mean, in accounting, or if you're an accountant or a lawyer or whatever, people don't come right out and say, I don't like what you did there with that spreadsheet. That's not good. Change it. Because it's not subjective. The creative industry is entirely subjective. So you have to be the right personality, and you have to be okay with being told that your ideas are dumb, or your design is bad. So I think it takes I don't want to say special, because we're not special. It's just different. Obviously, creative people are quite different than accountants most of the time. But yeah, I definitely think you have to be okay with being told that your ideas are stupid. And that's what creative people do, is come up with 10 ideas, knowing the 9 of them are nuts and they will never see the light of day. But 10% of the time, they're going to hit on something very, very cool. And I talk about one of the pieces of my book, and something I've talked about in presentations a lot, is the idea, crazy ideas change the world. Crazy ideas are going to be what reverses the trend of declining attendance in athletics. Right. It was a crazy idea to think that you could ever communicate with somebody across town without going over, you're riding your horse over there to talk to them. Then it was, you know, they invented the telephone and you could talk to them. And now you can speak to your telephone and, you know, pull it out of your pocket and say, call Brian, and it does it, and you don't have to do anything. So it's those crazy ideas that change the world. 90% of which are completely nuts and don't work. But that 10% is what you count on.
I love that. I want to dig into the focus of your book and a lot of the things you're doing with fan behavior and engagement and building attendance. But I really want to hammer into this agency thing a little bit more. You start your own firm, you're going to work, you're stressing over the bills and things like that. How did you start getting clients and having somebody commit to you and say, you're worthy, I want to work with you, and that get it all started? How did that happen?
It's all about... For me, it was the connections I'd made while I was working at Oklahoma. I was very, very lucky and fortunate. Kirby Hocutt, the athletic director at Texas Tech now, and former chairman of the college football playoff. Rick Hart, the current athletic director at SMU. Joe Parker, the current athletic director at Colorado State. And then obviously Joe Castiglione, still at Oklahoma. That was my network. Okay. I left having an unbelievable network of people that were willing to make phone calls on my behalf and send me work. You know, Joe Parker was my first client when he was at Michigan, and he's been a client everywhere at all of his stops, and he's been an unbelievable friend. And all of those people were willing to make, Rick Hart called, his father was the AD at Florida State at the time, called his contacts there, said, hey, give this guy a shot. Florida State's still a client to this day. He called his friends at North Carolina. North Carolina's still a client to this day. It's you know, you have to, it's all of what my dad always said, it's all about, you know, who you know gets you there, what you know keeps you there. And who I knew definitely got some doors opened. Now you have, you know, had to deliver, and you have to do great work and you have to have great customer service. And that's something we've always been focused on, because creatives are not known for doing things on time, on budget, and being communicative. Fortunately, I had that, you know, that skill, and my staff gets tired of hearing me say it, but I always say, what's worse than being late? Nothing. Because I truly believe there is nothing worse than being late, especially in an industry where that first football game happens, whether that intro video or that poster or whatever it is ready to go or not. That game is going to happen. So you can't be late. So I don't know if I think I went off on a tangent there. But point is, I had an unbelievable group of people that I started out with that made I called in a lot of favors there initially. I got some clients, and then I delivered it. I worked my tail off to make sure that I didn't allow them to regret making that call on my behalf.
Zach, tangents are totally acceptable on this show. We do a lot of tangents. You'll notice I go in a lot of different directions based on whatever's happening up inside my brain right now. So I get it. That was gold. So I'm glad that you went that direction. So marketing, such a broad term. We have so many people in our audience who want to work in marketing. They're studying it. They're in college, you know, whatever. There's creative. There's activation. There's tracking and conversion. There's communication and copywriting side. There's video editing. There's so much that goes into it. In your experience, you run an agency. You've hired and fired people for your entire career. You know what to mm-hmm. look for and people that are hiring your agency, what they want. Do you think it's better, or what somebody should focus on? Do you think it's better for somebody to have a specialized focus and talent as they're kind of coming up in their college education? Or is it smarter to be more versatile and be able to do a little bit of everything? What's kind of your viewpoint on that?
My opinion has always been that asking somebody that's 22 years old to decide what they want to do with the rest of their lives should be criminal.
Yeah.
It should be against the law to require somebody to even declare a major until they're a junior. So I think I'm formulating this as it comes out of my mouth, so it might not be very well thought out.
No, I like that. That's good.
I don't like the idea that we would ask somebody to be specialized at 22, 25, 28 years old. I didn't know what I wanted to do until I still don't know what I want to do with my life. It's just been the path that I've been placed on, and luckily I enjoy it. I think the most important skill you can have as you graduate and start looking for jobs is a willingness to try. Motivation, drive is so much more important than talent in my mind. I can teach somebody, if you have a basic skills in design, I can teach you to be a good designer. If you have basic desire and abilities in regards to research or data, I can teach you the rest. What I can't teach, and I have said this multiple times, I can't teach drive. I can't teach motivation. I can't teach communication. Those are the skills that are far more important. I can't teach you to be on time. You either are or you're not driven, motivated, on time. So those skills are far more important. So my suggestion or recommendation there would be, don't decide, because you're going to change your mind. You get too specialized too early, and that's your pigeonhole in that the rest of your life.
No, that makes perfect sense. How do you identify that in somebody? Because all those soft skills, I totally agree with you that, you know, leadership, teamwork, hard work, work ethic, all that kind of thing is so much more important. I mean, I've seen it in my entire career that sort of want is so much more important than all just the little tactical skills you're able to execute on. But how do you find that in people? How do you identify that in a phone interview or an interview process or off a resume? I mean, how do you, I don't know. I've never become great at that. I don't know how you are. What's your process?
So much of it is in those things, the cover letter, the following directions. I'm very specific in what I ask for when people apply for jobs, and if they don't follow the rules or follow the directions, they're not considered.
I like that.
If I say email info@oldhatcreative.com to apply for a job, and they email me directly, that they didn't follow directions. That may be, you know, if they email info at and they email me, well, okay, at least they followed the direction, and I appreciate their, reaching out to me directly. But I will ask for a cover letter, a resume, a list of references, and if it's a design position, I'll ask for a portfolio or a link to a portfolio. If I don't get all four of those things, they're not considered. If they don't write a cover letter that is directed at me, at my company, they're not considered. I've gotten right. So many cover letters that are, dear sir, I would love to work at your company. Well, don't send me that. I mean, it's going directly in the trash. So those types of things give me a feel for the type of person that I'm dealing with before they even walk in the door. I always schedule interviews first thing in the morning to see if they can be on time. If it's the younger the person, I always schedule for Friday morning because they're accustomed to going out late on Thursday nights if they've been in college recently. So 8 a.m. on Friday morning, and if they're a minute late, ideally they're 10 minutes early. They're sitting there waiting on me. Right. Those are the kinds of things you can do, tons and tons of little things like that to get a feel for who you're dealing with. My creative director right now, his name is Dustin Schmidt. He was a student athlete at Kansas State years ago. He had the job when I read his cover letter. It was that good. He knocked it out of the park, and I would have, I went through the whole process with him, and he just confirmed my beliefs. But he did everything right, from cover letter to portfolio to everything about him was perfect. And he's been here over a decade now, and leads all of our creative. You can get a job with your cover letter. I believe that. At least here you can.
I love that. And I love all the little steps and those little moments, those little micro decisions that each person makes, showing up early, putting the attention into the details of what you're asking for. All those things are so important and so often get overlooked. And I'm glad that you guys put an emphasis on that. One of the other things I noticed on the Old Hat site, I loved this. I mean, I do a lot of research before my interviews. I want to make sure I ask intelligent questions. But I saw this, what you shared on your site, and it said, "At Old Hat, we take our work seriously, but definitely not ourselves. There's no room for prima donnas or big egos around here. We all know how to roll up our sleeves and get our hands dirty." How important is it being transparent in establishing and maintaining a corporate culture? Because I read that and it's like you're basically saying, this is who we want to be a part of our team and our culture. You're being very clear about what you want. How important is that in creating your own internal culture and maintaining it?
Well, I think people have to know, that's an external message as much as an internal one. We want everybody externally to know, we're not full of ourselves. We know what we do, and we know how lucky we are to do what we do. You're not going to deal with, big egos here. It's just not how it works. And then internally, whether we're communicating that message to our existing staff and reminding them what we're about, or appealing to new employees, letting them know, hey, don't come here and expect to be, if your job title is research director or research assistant, that doesn't mean that's all you're going to do. It means, if there's a project that is due or whatever's going on, you're going to be asked to help out in whatever capacity you can, because there is no, I hate the term, that's not my job. Well, yes, it is.
Yeah.
Everything is your job. Everything that can move this company forward is your job. Everything that can help our clients achieve the goals that we've told them that we're going to achieve for them is your job. Don't tell me that's not your job.
I love that. I love the establishing that and being so clear about it and what your expectations are. You've written two books. So it's like, okay, so it's not enough running your own agency and all the other things you've got doing. You've also written two books. So I'm basically looking up at you and saying, okay, I have no more excuses. your first book was If Not for Athletics. And your most recent book is Winning is Not a Strategy, A Game-Changing Approach for Driving Attendance. In your view and your experience, is the sports industry headed in the right direction? And if not, because all we ever hear about are the positives, ratings are up here, the revenue's up here, the salaries are going through the roof. Do you feel like the sports industry is headed in the right direction? And if not, how would you kind of suggest they change course?
Well, obviously, in some aspects, it certainly is. There are a lot of positives to report. At the same time, there are areas where we can improve. What is it, 7 years in a row, 8 years in a row now, college football has seen a decline in attendance. That's not good. And that, ticket revenue is still a huge part of paying those salaries. I'm not arrogant enough to think that I know more than the people I mentioned earlier, Kirby and Rick and Joe. These guys are the ones that truly know the ins and outs. I know about marketing, and I know how that aspect of it. So to say, is it headed in the right direction? It is really difficult for me to see the salaries that these coaches are making when they're averaging 500 seasons and they're still making in non-revenue sports that lose money, they're making $350,000 a year, and you're like, I don't get it. Entrepreneurial side of me is like, I couldn't run a business like that, so I don't know how that works. I am very hopeful. For a little bit, I'll be honest. For a while, I was not seeing the industry embrace the idea of doing what needed to be done, of marketing the right way, of actually developing strategies behind your creative. It is slow to be adopted, but fortunately my book has done very well, and that is encouraging because it shows me that people in the industry are like, okay, maybe we do need to get more creative, maybe we do need to embrace a new way of marketing, because what we're doing is not working. I mean, we're doing more marketing now. We are putting out more content, the industry is, than ever in the history of athletics. You got more stuff going out on social media, more marketing initiatives than ever before, and attendance is dropping. Something's wrong there. But the industry seems to recognize that, seems to be embracing the idea, okay, we have to invest in research, we have to invest in data. So I think that if they weren't, then I would be very discouraged. But the fact of the matter is, I'm seeing a lot of those things being done, and that will yield positive results, I believe. The industry was, I'm going on, I know, long-winded, but I think the industry got very, very spoiled for many, many years because there was zero competition. You couldn't watch your favorite team from your couch on a high definition television. A lot of the games you had to listen to on the radio, and you certainly didn't have a better view of the game from your couch than you did from the stadium. Well, now that's not true. Every game's on, not just on my high definition television, but on my high definition telephone. I can be at my kids' sporting events watching my other sporting events on my phone. So we were spoiled for a really, really long time, and now we're realizing, okay, this isn't being handed to us any longer. We actually have to treat our product like it's a product and not like it's a privilege to consume. I think that's how sports treated its product for many, many years, is you're lucky to be able to come to our events, and it's just not the case anymore.
So is it making it more of a audience-focused product? I mean, is that what we're driving towards here? Because I'm in the same boat. I'm a content creator, so I'm always battling the noise, right? I'm always battling all the different voices out there and marketing and content and podcasts and whatever else. That's a conversation I think everybody has, is how do you cut through that? And you're saying, I think, if I'm hearing you correctly, that the teams and the athletic programs have taken the audience for granted in a way. And is their goal now to turn that back focused on the audience themselves? And how do they do that? Am I hearing you correctly?
It should be their focus for sure. We have to get over this idea that our product has anything to do with what's happening on the field or the court or the surface of play. That's not our product anymore. Used to be that was our product because that was the only place people could consume it. But if you can get, you know, if you can get a Dr. Pepper at home versus going to 7-Eleven, you're just going to stay home, because why would you go to 7-Eleven to get something you can get at home? That's not our product is not what's happening on the field of play. Our product is the experience. Our product is, we did a survey. We've done multiple surveys, tons and tons, thousands of fans all across the country in every market, and surveyed them and said, what are the top two reasons you attend events? The industry believes it's to witness a quality opponent and to see your team win. Fans don't say that anymore. Fans say the reasons they attend an event are for the game, the experience of watching the game live, and the social aspect of attending a live sporting event. So it's the experience. It's the that is our product. It's the experience that we have to make amazing. And there are tons, hundreds of ways of doing that. And then the social aspect, there are ways of doing that. But long story short, we have to get over the idea that our product has anything to do with the 25-year-olds, you know, that are running around in a square, a grass square, because that's not our product.
It's so interesting to hear you say that, because one thing I've noticed recently in touring more of the new stadiums, so like I was down at Mercedes-Benz Stadium in Atlanta recently, and I've kept up with a lot of the other ones they're building through different people I know in the industry, and it seems like at the arena level they're doing that. They're trying to make these more experience-driven. They have like little pockets of little places you can go within the arena, so it's not about come in and park your butt in a seat and watch. It's more about walk around, check this scene out. They've got a bar over here. We got this restaurant over here. We got this kid club over here. We've got this different experience for you to engage and interact with at the game outside of just sitting and watching. Is that kind of the direction you're talking about?
Yeah, and that's why I said that I was encouraged by the okay. direction we're going is because for that very reason, you see teams start to embrace this idea. You know, the number two reason people attend events, as I said, for the social aspect. Well, where can you not be social at an event? In your seats.
Right.
We take away the number two reason people attend events, we take away the second they sit down in their seats. So we do things like kiss cams and dance cams, and those. That is a way to be more social, because you see yourself and your friends on the video boards. But it's not enough. You create these areas where people can socialize more. I'll tell you, the areas where teams typically are not having trouble selling tickets is the clubs, the suites. These areas, you know, the loge boxes, these areas where people can move around and socialize. So we have to figure out a way, you know, to make those bleacher seats more social. And we have ideas on how to do that. It's just a matter of, you know, getting those out there and implementing them. And nine of the, as we talked about, nine of those 10 ideas are not going to work, but there's going to be one that is going to be huge, and it's going to change things.
So you also have a great podcast, Winning is Not a Strategy, which, you know, goes right along with your book. I suggest everyone subscribe to it, and I don't usually endorse people that are competing with me in this industry.
I appreciate that.
No, it's great. I think it's great. So recently you talked about the squirrel generation and the challenges of marketing to this group and getting them engaged with sports events. First, you have to explain the squirrel generation to everybody, because I think it's really cool, and then help us better understand what you've learned from this group as they relate to sports events.
So the squirrel generation came, it's one of very few things that I can claim is all my own. I came up with that term when I was thinking about, when I was reading that we have 7.5 seconds to grab their attention, because their attention is so easily, you know, because they're so easily distracted. And it made me think of the dog from the movie Up, that every time he hears a noise, he thinks squirrel, you know, and looks the other direction. That's who we're dealing with.
Yeah.
This generation that if you don't grab them in 7.5 seconds, then they're on to something else. They have the attention span of a goldfish. And so, I think millennials, we had like 15 seconds. Now we have 7.5. And I guess the next generation, we're going to have a negative amount of time to grab their attention. But, a good friend of mine, Craig Pintons, the AD at Loyola Marymount, in LA, said, and I believe this to be true, every generation you market to differently, and you have different challenges and opportunities. At the end of the day, you have to make your events the place to be. If you don't do that, it doesn't matter how much time you have to grab the attention if your event isn't the place to be. So that's step one. Make your event something that everybody wants to be at. And number two, with this generation, it is a matter of unfortunately, you have to cater to. You have to be, live where they live. You have to, get on their phones. I still see, walk across campuses across the United States, and I see, sandwich boards advertising the most upcoming event. Nobody sees that.
Right.
Because, they're walking across the campus staring at their phones. They're going to see a sandwich board. I mean, it's crazy. So meet them where they live, if that's your focus, figure out what's your student body, what social media platform, make it animated, make it less than 7.5 seconds long, get them there the first time. And then, what we can't rely on is that they're going to keep showing up. Once they come the first time, you have to make that event, make it social. These guys are more social than any group before them. They have more options. This is a generation that is used to getting on Netflix and scrolling for a half an hour, waiting for that one thing that's going to grab their attention. They're used to having lots of options. And so again, back to making our product amazing. It's not good. It's not, it doesn't work to be good anymore. You have to be great at every single aspect of your event. It all has to be great.
Is this where you focus now with your agency? I mean, I imagine things have changed over your 15 years in business. Is old hat now more focused than ever on that digital content, on, push notifications or whatever it needs to be in order to engage in that quick 7 to 10 second window? Or are you able to convince that your clients that that's what they need to do? Is that part of the challenge, is almost educating them to where fan behavior is right now?
Well, yeah, it's identified. It depends on the engagement, but if students are who we're targeting, which I think we all should be, it's finding ways, finding unique ways to one, advertise to them digitally. This speaking of what this generation is and isn't okay with. They don't mind being advertised to. Millennials hated being advertised to. They don't mind it. It's weird the way the research and what it shows. They don't mind being advertised to. So getting that content in front of them, getting them there, and then giving helping universities or whatever, I guess, whatever athletic organization we're working with, give them an experience that they keep coming back to. But you mentioned it earlier, marketing encompasses so many things. From video production, graphic design, data analytics, research, et cetera. And we try to do it all once we figure out whatever that goal is that the organization is trying to achieve, then we tailor something toward helping them achieve that goal.
I think that's great. It's obvious that the challenges continue to evolve as the audience continues to change. Like you said earlier, that you're marketing differently to each generation because they all have different needs. And I find that fascinating that this generation doesn't mind being advertised to, much like the millennials were so adverse to it. That's interesting to know. I mean, you really have to get into the science of it and the data behind it to really get a full grasp of how you need to deliver. I want to finish up with a real softball here because I know you've got a busy day ahead of you. You got a lot going on. I appreciate all the time you've been giving me and all this great advice, but we'll finish up with something really easy. Where can people get your book, and who do you look at as your target market? Now everybody knows they can subscribe to your podcast, Winning Is Not a Strategy, anywhere you listen to podcasts, but where can they get the book, and who is this really aimed at?
Hopefully I can swing and knock this one out of the park. Thanks for the softball. You can get Winning Is Not a Strategy on Amazon. You can also order an autographed copy directly from me at winningisnotastrategy.com. The target, I think there are there's value that can be taken away from anybody that works, not just in sports, in entertainment, anybody that wants to drive attendance to whether it's a museum or a zoo or a professional event, sporting event or a minor league or college. I will say that those that are struggling, to drive attendance and have more limited resources, this is really targeted at that group. So if you're, you know, the minor leagues, the university ranks, those that are charged with have 25 sports they have to market with a 3-person marketing staff, that's probably the group that's going to get the greatest value out of this book.
Great stuff, Zach. Thanks so much for giving me a piece of what's going on inside your creative mind there and sharing what you've learned and the data sets and all the different advancements that are happening in the marketing side of things. I know everybody will really enjoy listening to this, so thanks for coming on.
Well, thanks for having me. This has been a lot of fun. I appreciate it.
Thank you to Zach Logsdon from Old Hat Creative. What a great sports marketing agency he has built there. His client list is incredible. If you go to their website, check it out. It's really cool to see all the different things they're up to and see their different marketing campaigns and the programs they work with. I found it really interesting that when we dug into what he looks for when hiring and the rules he kind of establishes and also what he expects out of people, that there's that hunger, that deep hunger, more than there is this versatility or these crazy skill patterns. Like, he's looking for people that have a story to tell, that can sell it in their cover letter, that can have that portfolio, but also who are willing and coachable and willing to learn and put in that extra work. Such important stuff to know. And then on the actual marketing side and on the fan behavior side and on the, you know, how long somebody's actually paying attention to your messaging and going where they are. I mean, all just such fascinating stuff from the side of fan marketing and event management and fan behavior and all of those different disciplines that we work for. We're trying to get eyes on our product, right? All of us are in a way in product marketing, product management, trying to get eyes on our product, whether you're in content creation or anything else. So the more you can do to listen to these behavioral tips, that's the most important part, I think. It was really cool in the conversation. So thanks again to Zach and Old Hat. Make sure to check out our Facebook live session Thursday nights at 7:30 p.m. Eastern. That's direct from the Work in Sports Facebook page. It's Q&A style, lots of questions being asked about people's sports career focused questions. I have a little bit of a theme. I'll dig into some subjects, but really it's a listener driven conversation, which is a lot of fun. Also, we have a private Facebook group for fans of the podcast. We have tons of ways for you to interact and ask questions about your sports career, and we're here to help. I enjoy doing all of this. So that's it for today. Now it's time to get back to work.